Welcome to Peak Health, a radio show dedicated to empowering you to take back control of your health so that you can have the freedom to live the life that you want. I'm Lisa Morse, naturopathic physician on the island at Fern Cove Natural Medicine. I'm dedicated to helping you uncover the root cause of your symptoms so that you can get back on the road to feeling well again.
And I'm Claire DeNice, certified health and wellness coach and a personal trainer. Our show is going to bring you information to help you take charge of your health. We're going to cover topics like IBS, heartburn, thyroid disorders, autoimmune diseases, osteoporosis, nutrition, and lots more. Hey, Lisa. How are you today?
Good. How are you, Claire?
I'm good. So what's going on today?
So today we're going to talk about irritable bowel syndrome. It's a very common condition that, you know, conventional medicine says we just have to live with it.
Oh, so are you going to say we don't have to live with it?
Right. We don't have to live with it. You know, there are definitely underlying reasons for irritable bowel syndrome, and we can uncover those reasons so that people can get relief.
That would be great.
Yeah. The biggest things I see contributing to irritable bowel syndrome are food, diet, stress, and we're going to talk about these in detail.
Okay. So why don't you tell me how I would know if I had IBS?
Well, the classic symptoms are abdominal pain, abdominal bloating, constipation, and or diarrhea. Sometimes there's alternating. And some people have nausea, fatigue, or other non-gastrointestinal symptoms that go along with the irritable bowel syndrome. But it can be pretty miserable for some people, causing them to be fearful, to go out to do anything because they might have an accident. And it's actually associated with anxiety and depression, although we don't always know which came first, the IBS or the anxiety or depression.
So what do most, like, conventional MD doctors tell people that have irritable bowel syndrome?
Right. So, of course, there's a wide variation, but sometimes they'll give over-the-counter medications for diarrhea, such as Imodium, or they may give magnesium hydroxide, which is milk of magnesia, for constipation. Of course, it's not addressing the root cause of the problem, just trying to get rid of the symptoms. And then there's also some other pharmaceuticals that are used, including antidepressants and also antispasmodic drugs, which help to lessen the spasms in the abdomen.
Well, that's a big word, antispasmodic.
Yes, yes.
And antidepressants, that's interesting.
Yeah, yes. Sometimes at lower doses than, you know, antidepressants are typically prescribed at for depression. And we don't really know the mechanism as to why these medications can be sometimes effective for irritable bowel syndrome. And most studies actually show that at the low doses that they're given, they don't change anxiety or depression that's present, but they may change the irritable bowel syndrome symptoms that are present. So again, they're not likely getting to the root cause of the irritable bowel syndrome.
You said root causes, or at least root help, would focus on stress, diet, and exercise.
Diet.
I forget what you said.
Yeah, stress, diet. I also forgot to mention a big word called dysbiosis, which is an imbalance of the bacteria. We're going to talk plenty about that. But yeah.
Okay. I'm just trying to take all this in. So medications try to eradicate the symptoms. And what if they don't work?
Right. So typically patients, if the medications don't change the symptom picture, then they're usually told that they just have to live with it. Something they're going to have to deal with for the rest of your life.
Sounds awful.
Yeah.
And that is too bad.
Yeah, it is. And there's so much more that we can do to help people get over irritable bowel syndrome. And I want people to know that they don't have to accept their doctor's sentence that they will have to live with it for the rest of their life.
Sounds like almost like jail time.
Yeah.
So let's talk about it. Can you give me the scoop on poop?
Yeah, totally. So I want to say that there can be more than one cause of irritable bowel syndrome. And it can take some work to figure it out, but we're going to talk about all of them today. So first thing I want to talk about is diet. It's one obvious cause of IBS and would be food allergies or food intolerances. And that can be uncovered through elimination diet or actually food allergy testing.
So tell me more about an elimination diet.
Yeah, many of you may already know about elimination diets if you've worked with Kathy Abascal. But basically, you eliminate certain foods that are known to be allergenic for a certain amount of time, let's say 3 to 4 weeks. And, you know, we hope that the symptoms go away during that time. If they don't, then we suspect there's either another food allergy or intolerance that wasn't eliminated, or the cause is something in addition to or instead of a food allergy.
Okay. Well, what kind of foods do you eliminate when you're on an elimination diet?
Right. So the main allergens or foods that are found to be allergenic are gluten, dairy, soy, eggs, citrus, nightshades, corn, sugar, caffeine, food additives, and alcohol.
Whoa, I thought you were going to run out of breath there. That's such a long list. That yes. Sounds intense and difficult. And like, maybe we should talk about what you can eat.
Right. Well, so depending on what your diet is now, you know, if you're eating the standard American diet, you know, fast foods, frozen dinners, convenience foods, it's going to be a big change for you. You know, but when I'm working with a patient who wants to do an elimination diet, I provide resources that I give to help them figure out what to eat.
Okay. Well, what if you don't want to do an elimination diet?
Right.
Do you have a choice?
Well, yes, you do. So the other option is a food allergy test. You know, however, I always tell my patients that these tests can produce false positive and false negatives. So meaning that the test might say you aren't allergic to a certain food, but you are. And then it might say that you are allergic to something when you really aren't. There's a certain psychological part that comes from doing the test. Like, you know, what if you aren't really allergic to a certain food and then you get this test that says you are? And then sometimes people can become afraid to eat that food anymore when in actuality it doesn't harm them. And then in addition, the tests don't check for food intolerances. So an allergy is when your immune system is actually reacting to the food. You're producing antibodies to the food, whereas an intolerance is a little bit different. You aren't digesting that food properly, such as in a lactose intolerance. You can't digest the lactose. So, you know, doing the food allergy test, it doesn't guarantee that you're not missing food intolerances. So I find that the elimination diet is really the best way to determine your food allergies or intolerances.
It might also be a little easier for someone who wants to ease into finding out about this. Allergies.
The testing?
Yeah. And allergies and intolerances. Elimination, if you did the elimination and you didn't feel better, after eliminating a food for 3 or 4 weeks, then you could move into some of the other options?
The other things that cause irritable bowel syndrome, you mean?
Yeah,
we're going to talk about that. I mean,
okay.
You could do the food allergy test as a guide, you know, and then
branch. But you're not sure because you
right.
said sometimes it gives
false
positive.
Yeah. But you can start off with that as a guide and then work further from there. So
you could try some other eliminations, maybe?
You mean, yeah, after you do the food allergy test, you could branch off from there. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you used another word there that I was a little unsure about. Dysbiosis? Dysbiosis?
Yeah. So I guess, that kind of what I was talking about was... the reason I started talking about that was because if the elimination diet didn't, you know, you didn't feel better after that, you can, there's certain diets. One of them is called the FODMAP, and it's a really big, important one for people with IBS. It actually is very helpful. And the other one is a specific carbohydrate diet. So these actually look at dysbiosis, or they are involved with dysbiosis, which is often a common cause of irritable bowel syndrome. And it just means that there's an imbalance of the good and bad bacteria in the gut. So we could have an overgrowth of yeast, or we could have too much bacteria in the small intestine where it's not really supposed to be. And we're going to talk more about that. But studies are showing that actually as many as 60% of people with irritable bowel syndrome have a condition called SIBO. And it's an acronym, capital S, capital I, capital B, capital O. SIBO, and it stands for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth.
Oh, that's interesting. Before I get totally off track, I just want to make sure I'm following you. So there's various kinds of diets.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And it's a little bit of a treasure hunt, maybe, to figure it all out.
Patience.
It's actually pretty interesting. And actually, I have heard a little bit about SIBO, but would you tell me more about it?
Yeah, so we know that our digestive tract contains a lot of bacteria. Actually, the amount of bacteria in our body is greater than the amount of cells in our body. It's pretty wild.
Wow.
But it's actually the large intestine that has the most bacteria. The small intestine is not really supposed to have a lot of bacteria. And if somehow the levels of the bacteria in the small intestine become excessive, then the bacteria here, they digest the foods that we eat, and they like some foods more than others. And what they do is they release gas in the process, and which causes gas and bloating. And in addition, the gases actually damage the lining of the small intestine and lead to diarrhea or constipation, depending on which gas is produced.
Okay, but how would I get increased amount of bacteria in the small intestine?
Good question.
That's the wrong place for it?
Yeah, there's numerous possible causes, but the main one is lack of movement in the small intestine. So our small intestine is designed to move the food through it, and if that's not happening, then it allows for overgrowth of the bacteria.
Okay, so, and why would my small intestine stop moving?
Another good question. Well, research is finding that actually an incident of food poisoning can actually damage the nerves of the small intestine that help to contract to move food through the small intestine. So sometimes people develop irritable bowel syndrome after an incident of food poisoning, and actually the root cause is the small intestine is not moving properly. And of course, there are other reasons that the small intestine is not moving. It could be stress, or it can be low stomach acid.
I see. Well, it sounds really complicated.
Yeah.
what kinds of treatments are done to help?
Yeah.
The SIBO condition.
Well, yeah. For SIBO, the first thing is reducing the bacterial numbers with antimicrobials. You could either use antibiotics, pharmaceuticals, or herbal antimicrobials. And then we have to work on adjusting the diet. And that's where the FODMAP or the specific carbohydrate diet comes in. For those of you listening who aren't familiar, FODMAP is an acronym also. And it's F-O-D as in dog, M-A-P. So FODMAP. So anyways, these diets are low in foods that the bacteria like to eat. And so, you know, first it's reducing the bacteria, second it's the diet, and then the third is we have to work on the motility of the gastrointestinal tract. And there's some medications as well as herbal products that can do this. And so the key to helping people with SIBO is to address the motility of the small intestine, because if we don't address that, then the condition will return soon after killing the bacteria.
So if you've had an incident of food poisoning, does that mean you're wrecked forever?
No.
Oh, good. So okay. Just checking. So tell me more about the FODMAP diet and the specific carbohydrate diet.
Yeah.
Too.
So FODMAP stands for, are you ready for this?
I think.
Fermentable, oligosaccharide, disaccharide, monosaccharide, and polyols. Sounds complicated.
I think FODMAP's easier to remember.
Correct. But basically, it's foods that the bacteria love to eat, which causes a problem when there's too much bacteria in the small intestine. Some of the foods are onions, beans, dairy products, wheat products, honey, and then certain fruits and vegetables.
Those are things you do eat or don't eat?
Those are things that are high in FODMAPs.
Okay.
So, yeah, they can be a problem. So onions and beans, those are big, like, IBS.
And really, even fruits and vegetables?
Yeah. I mean, those are good for us. Of course, they are. But with certain specific ones, they can contribute to the increased gas and bloating. But, you know, once we address the bacterial overgrowth and work on the underlying cause, then the person will be able to eat those foods again.
I like that you said at the very beginning that there's hope for us. That,
oh, yes.
You know, and it's not something you have to live with forever.
Yeah. Yeah. So the other diet is the specific carbohydrate diet. And actually, it was originally designed for people who had inflammatory bowel disease, which is a condition that's more serious than irritable bowel syndrome. It's actually an autoimmune disease, and ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. That's what we're talking about when we say inflammatory bowel disease. Like I said, that the specific carbohydrate diet was originally designed for those types of patients, but it's also helpful for people with SIBO, and it's low in fermentable foods. Yeah. To prevent the bacteria from feeding on those foods. So if you have IBS, I would highly recommend trying out different diets. You know, the elimination diet or the FODMAP diet or the specific carbohydrate diet.
Well, what if I've tried all those diets and I'm still having problems?
Yeah, it can be frustrating for sure.
I'm sure,
There are other types of diets, like a low salicylate diet, a low oxalate diet, you know, things to investigate. And I recommend, you know, working with a practitioner who can help you with that. But again, going to go back to maybe there's something else like dysbiosis.
Dysbiosis.
Right.
And SIBO, so, those are common causes of irritable bowel syndrome.
Yeah.
What else?
Well, so we have to look at the large intestine. We can have dysbiosis there. We have to look at the balance of bacteria in the large intestine. And this is where probiotics come in, as well as prebiotics. So prebiotics are food for good bacteria. Now, I forgot to mention when we were talking about SIBO is that prebiotics can often aggravate people that have SIBO. So the bugs in the small intestine eat the prebiotics and they grow more, and they will cause worse irritable bowel syndrome symptoms. So if you have IBS and you're taking a probiotic with a prebiotic, you might want to get a different probiotic. And the way you can know if it has a prebiotic is there's different types of prebiotics, but inulin is one of them, or arabinoglactans is another one. I know that's kind of a long word.
Yeah. I think they should come work with you.
Yes, exactly. Seek someone who can help you evaluate what you're taking. But anyways, we want to see what's happening in the large intestine. And so we can get some ideas about, we can also get some ideas about how other organs are functioning that are important in digestion with a stool specimen or a stool sample. So it will tell us what's going on with the bugs in the large intestine as far as yeast, overgrowth, whether there's any parasites, and how the other organs of digestion are functioning. So we can get a lot of information from a stool test.
You know, I just want to say before I confuse myself, if you have just recently tuned in, we are discussing irritable bowel syndrome. This is Lisa and Claire with Peak Health. Our topic today is the scoop on poop.
Yes.
And it's seeming pretty complicated. So far, we've talked about food allergies and intolerances, dysbiosis, including SIBO, and now yeast, parasites, or other digestive organ dysfunction. So, what do you mean about other digestive organ dysfunction, Lisa?
Yeah, well, the whole digestive process is pretty complex. The organs I'm talking about are the stomach, the liver, the gallbladder, and the pancreas. First, we have to be producing enough stomach acid, which is actually another fairly common problem, especially in the older population. But we need to have proper stomach acid to properly digest our foods. And as we age, production of stomach acid actually decreases. And when this happens, it affects the rest of our digestion because the presence of stomach acid causes the release of other digestive enzymes such from the gallbladder and the pancreas. So if those aren't working properly, then we can't digest protein or fat. And this is why acid blocking medications actually can cause more digestive problems, because without stomach acid, we can't digest our food.
Interesting. Is there anything else you can think of that can contribute to people's IBS?
Absolutely. The list goes on, right? The nervous system, it's definitely involved with our digestion. Our digestive tract has its own nervous system. It's called the enteric nervous system. And that has to be functioning properly for good digestion. So when I talk about the nervous system, I'm talking about anxiety or stress. And I want to say that if we have disturbances in our digestion, those can cause anxiety and depression. But the reverse is true. Anxiety and depression can also cause digestive problems. And so people who have a lot of anxiety frequently are in what we call the sympathetic state. And we've chatted about this in previous shows. But it's the stressed out part of our nervous system where we're constantly on alert. And that actually prohibits the digestive tract from working properly. We don't release hydrochloric acid in our stomach when we're stressed out or in the sympathetic phase. The muscles of our digestive tract don't contract properly to move the food through. And then other digestive enzymes don't get released. So it actually being stressed out sets a person up for developing dysbiosis, the imbalance of the, good and bad bugs, and also food allergies.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I think we've talked about stress being a huge, huge contributor to health in our previous shows too. So some people, aren't even aware of how anxious they are. And, it can be a learned emotion from our childhood that we carry through our life. And it can actually take some work to uncover that and develop new habits. So I would definitely say that anxiety can be a root cause of irritable bowel syndrome, and an anxious mood leaves you more susceptible to food allergies and dysbiosis. And so we can treat those things. We can treat the food allergies and the dysbiosis. But if we don't address the stress and anxiety, it will be more difficult to resolve.
So what would you want people to take away from today's show?
Yeah. So I want people to have hope for recovering from irritable bowel syndrome. Yeah. It might be hard work, but feeling better is possible. And, I would just tell people to, we have to understand that it's likely a combination of things. And it could be, like I said, the foods, it could be, the bacteria or yeast or parasites, or it could be stress. And it can be a complex thing to untangle. So I really recommend that people find a doctor that can help them investigate all the possible causes. So
back to stress.
Yeah.
We talked about stress as one of our secrets to vitality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my observation is it's almost impossible not to be stressed.
That's true. Especially in our society.
Yeah. We all have really busy schedules. It's kind of, in vogue to be busy. If you're not, then I don't know. You're not somebody.
Yeah.
Just nominally, I would remind that we talked about square breathing the other day.
Yeah, we did.
Last week, I guess.
Yeah.
As a technique to begin to relax the nervous system into parasympathetic instead of sympathetic.
Yes. Do you want to remind our listeners about if they didn't hear our previous talk?
Yeah, sure. Square breathing is a type of yoga breathing, and it's really very simple. It's just inhaling for a certain count and then holding it with your lungs inflated for the same count and the same tempo, and then exhaling all the air out of your lungs at the same tempo, and then keeping the same tempo holding no air in your lungs for the same count. Mm-hmm. And then, so I call that a square, like inhale, hold, exhale, hold, and do that like 4 or 5 times.
Yeah.
To, you know, sort of take control of something that we do automatically. Mm-hmm. But like when we are stressed, we tend to breathe like really shallowly. And so the square breathing helps you breathe a little more deeply because you have to inhale completely and exhale completely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say, you know, the breathing is great. And but I would also just mention about, you know, that message from society again, like, you know, oh, being busy is in vogue. And, you know, maybe that's not doing, you know, a lot for the health of our society, and that to, you know, we can reject that idea, and that we can make our own priorities in our life and make our own decisions, and that we're not going to, you know, fill our schedule up to the maximum. And also, you know, we might change our reaction to stress. Like if we do have a busy schedule, you know, taking the, you know, 10 minutes to do breathing, or, you know, just paying attention to the messages that we're sending ourselves, like, you know, oh, I'm so busy, this is terrible, you know, versus saying, yes, you know, I have a lot on my plate, but it's going to be okay. I'll, you know, I'm going to get through it. So I think that's important, our reaction to stress.
Well, it's really just information until we put some kind of emotion to
exactly.
it, right?
Exactly. I agree. That's good.
I just thought of something, and now it's escaped me what it was about stress. That I was reading an article the other day about multitasking, and it was saying that the idea that multitasking is efficient and getting more done in a certain period of time is erroneous.
Correct.
And they did some studies where they actually timed how long it took the brain to shift gears. To the second task, and that it wasn't as efficient at doing either of the tasks while it was trying to multitask. So it was interesting to me to think, oh, well, okay, maybe I should just focus clearly on one thing at a time.
Absolutely.
And actually, I think that would help me feel less stressed.
I agree. When you've got 20 million things that you're thinking of doing and trying to get done at the same time, it can be overwhelming.
Yeah. And you know that the old story about you walked into the room to turn on the fan, and then you noticed that the curtain was lopsided. So you fixed the curtain, and then you turned around and you saw some papers that you needed to go. And then eventually you've got this whole list of things that you've started doing and haven't completed any of them.
Right.
So the ultimate multitasking disaster.
Yeah.
Not good.
Yeah. So I think we're about ready to wrap up today. And I know this was a lot of information that we talked about. And I'd like anyone out there to know, you know, who's suffering from IBS, that I offer a 15-minute consultation to find out how I can help you personally. And you can go to my website and find out more. It's www.ferncovenaturalmedicine.com. And my phone number is 206-693-4143.
When they want the 15-minute consultation, is that a complimentary one?
Oh,
or
yeah.
Do you have, it's complimentary?
Yes.
Cool.
It's complimentary, yeah. So, we can meet and, you know, I can see if I might be able to help you. So, yeah. All right. Well, this is Peak Health Radio Show, where we're dedicated to educate and inspire you to take back control of your health so that you can have the freedom to live the life that you desire.
So, what are we going to talk about next time?
Next time, yeah. We're going to talk about, I think, autoimmune disease next time.
Cool.
It's actually the autoimmune disease that you didn't know you had.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll be anxious to hear about that because evidently I don't know that I've got it yet.
Well,
it seems like a good seg from IBS, because can that be autoimmune as well?
IBS is not, but actually the gut health. Autoimmune actually results from a gut dysfunction. So, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
That makes sense. So, thanks everybody for listening. If you do ever have anything you would like to hear us talk about, I'm certainly going to Lisa's website that she just mentioned would be a great idea, and leave us a message.
Yeah. Sounds good. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye, Lisa.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.